This week, a Danish citizen turns himself in to challenge DRM and copyright. Government issued email addresses in Turkey for cradle-to-grave surveillance. And 8 million cell phone GPS traces in the past year by Sprint and Nextel. This is Pirate Party Radio, Episode 6, for Thursday, December 3rd, 2009.
James Spade.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, the European Union has leaked details of the secret ACTA negotiations in Korea, and guess what? It's exposed the industry minister's so-called public consultations on copyright as a total sham, because ACTA will deep-six Canada's ability to establish copyright policy. Further, it will strip thousands of citizens from the right to even use the Internet under the idiotic three strikes and you're out policy. Now, this government has no right to mandate to negotiate away our domestic copyright laws. So will the minister table in this House the mandate letter that was given to the negotiators to start the ACTA talks? The ACTA provisions read like a wish list for the U.S. corporate lobby, because it'll override any flexibility for WIPO, it will gut our domestic copyright policies, and it'll criminalize thousands of Internet users through the three strikes provision. Now, Canada needs a minister who's willing to stand up for the innovation agenda, not a minister who's acting like a hand puppet for the U.S. embassy. So why won't the minister table the act of negotiation so we can open it to public scrutiny?
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last components. People don't understand how big this really is.
Hello, I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, your source for news on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. You can get to the Pirate Party website by going to piratepartyradio.com. And that intro sample that you heard in the beginning was from CPAC with some Canadian politicians talking about the secret negotiations of ACTA and how this worldwide corporate legislation will affect Canadian copyright laws. And I'll talk a little bit more about that at the top of the news. But first, some incoming messages from listeners. This message is from Bucky Fuller, commenting on the Mininova torrent site policy change that happened this week. If anybody out there didn't hear about this, Mininova took down the majority of their torrents to an opt-in-only torrent list. So all the torrents are gone except for the people who have registered their own torrents, and they have to prove that they own the copyright to these torrents. So all the rest are gone. Bucky Fuller comments, Mininova torrent site, ship sinking. Question for you as well, Sim. One by one, the torrent sites go down. What are the alternatives to come? You personally always seem confident that something will replace it. People are innovative. They're just driving it underground. Where, through that logic, is this faith, hope, or optimism of yours coming from, and why? Sincerely, a longtime listener of yours, Bucky Fuller. Well, this confidence that I have comes from a long line of shutdowns and reemergences of file-sharing networks, along with the innovations every time there's a closure or a change. And this was shown with torrents after Napster was shut down, and now with open trackers, or even trackerless torrent sites using DHT, like the Pirate Bay is now using. And this could be expanded even further by that Mandelbot kind of futuristic fictional story that I told last week at the end of the show, where somebody was envisioning a future of wireless auto-magical sneaker nets, where you had a portable hard drive that filled up as you do walk by anonymous file exchanges with people that you just happen to pass by or sit next to on the bus or in the mall or wherever you are in school, and your hard drive fills up with stuff that you have recommended for yourself that you pick with likes or dislikes. Just listen to the end of the last show. And but stifling technology only spurs the innovations, as I mentioned before many times, and it pushes the activity of torrents or file sharing further underground with like encrypted private trading posts. And if the government goes so far as to start permanent lifetime bans with the two or three strikes like that's coming up in the UK in 2011, there's going to be a lot more Wi-Fi drive-by downloadings with people leaving their Wi-Fi open, people sitting in their car outside and getting their files that way. There's a numerous amounts of ways. They can randomize their MAC addresses or route themselves through Tor points. You can't stop the flow of data. You can only make more rules and make it more totalitarian and fill up the jails or fill up the coffers with ordinary citizens' money that are now being used to the new rules of ignoring copyright. People are used to it now. They live in a world where, as it could be put, copyright is not respected. But people are used to this, so they're not going to stop doing it. They're just going to find new ways as new technology comes out and new software that facilitates this. So putting people in jail or kicking them off the internet is not going to help, and it's going to come to a boiling point very shortly. And we've got a whole show filled with these kinds of stories, as you're going to see. The next one is a Twitter post from TechFreak. And my Twitter is @RantMedia, if you want to get a hold of me that way. I'd rather you go through the website. Sim, concerning the motion capture of my walk, and this is talking about from last Pirate Party radio show, of people capturing motion of movie stars and actors and singers and putting them in games and using them in ways that the singer supposedly never agreed to. And I extended this further into the real world, where people could be captured on the street if they needed to get more realistic looking and acting extras in video game characters. And TechFreak said, no way I would want that. Of course, I only have 140 characters at Twitter, so it's very short. Next letter is from Zeno Valant, and it's also addressing the same thing. On the no doubt Nirvana versus Activision thing, first of all, I doubt that Activision would have had features that allowed players to use the likeness of one artist to perform another artist's song unless their legal team had advised them that this was within the bounds of their contract with the band. Second, about your comments being captured in public, since I'm not a celebrity, I'd be pretty happy to find a clone of myself in a video game. But I can see how not everyone would be. Given that the situation you set up was based on being captured in public, I don't think that anyone who objected would be successful in pursuing damages through legal means, since there is no expectation of privacy in public. And also, he notes, the patent for podcasting, which I talked about last episode, the Electronic Frontier Foundation is looking for help busting this patent. Because, as you mentioned, the patent is ridiculously broad and pretty clearly filed after the invention of podcasting. And here's the EFF news release. So if you go to my go to the forum for Pirate Party Radio, you can find that link. And the EFF is looking for anybody out there that can help them find some definitive prior art in the podcast patent. So head over there if you have any information about knowledge of podcasting or podcast-like delivery systems that was put in place before, I believe the patent was 2003 it was filed, and any kind of episodic automatic delivery systems that was made before 2003. Go check out the website at EFF and help them. Strike down this patent could have far-reaching effects on all podcasters, because they could charge a fee and send shutdown notices if you're not paying them for their patent. And if you'd like to contact me or ask a question or leave a comment, just head over to the Pirate Party Radio website. It's piratepartyradio.com and fill out the feedback form that's on the front page. And heading over to the news, Canadian copyright law to trump ACTA, Clement says. And this was sent in by Sean Kennedy. This is from CBC.ca. Industry Minister Tony Clement responding to accusations that an international anti-counterfeiting agreement will criminalize everyday activity by Canadians says any such pact will be subservient to copyright rules created domestically. Clement said suggestions that Canada will lose its copyright sovereignty to anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, a deal being negotiated largely in private by the European Union and a number of countries, including the United States, Canada, and Australia, is fear-mongering. The ACTA negotiations, in fact, subservient to any legislation put forward in this House, Clement said Tuesday in response to NDP MP Charlie Angus, which I played at the top of the show, during question period in the House of Commons. Recent leaks from the negotiations indicate that parties are discussing a three strikes and you're out policy, which would result in individuals losing their internet access for a period of time after being accused three times of illegally sharing copyrighted content, such as movies or music. Other provisions could make it illegal to break the electronic locks, also known as digital rights management, put on content and devices. Angus said the leaked details have exposed the Canadian government's recent copyright consultations with the public as a total sham. ACTA will deep six Canada's right to abolish copyright policy, he said. Furthermore, it'll strip thousands of Canadians of the right to use the internet under the idiotic three strikes and you're out policy. Angus challenged Clement to table the ACTA negotiations in the Commons so they could be publicly scrutinized, but the industry minister did not reply. A year ago, Canadians revolted against proposed copyright reform legislation tabled by Clement's predecessor, Jim Prentice, which contained some of the provisions reported in ACTA. Tens of thousands of Canadians protested the proposal online and ultimately succeeded in getting it scrapped. Clement and Heritage Minister James Moore held countrywide consultations earlier this year to gather input from Canadians, much of which were good ideas, Clement said Tuesday. We'd gone further in terms of making sure that the public is aware of the issues involved in copyright renewal and reform than any other government, and we're proud of that record, he says. Well, I would tend to agree with the NDP member Charlie Angus in saying, put the information on the table. Stop doing these dealings in secrecy with the corporations that you're seemingly bowing to because you're not telling us, the citizens, what is going on behind closed doors. Our governments are keeping secrets from you that are not of national security issues. These are to do with copyright. This should be in the public. If the government is making decisions on copyright, the public should know what is going on and not keep it secret. And we can't even comment on these things except for the leaked documents. And you can go to WikiLeaks to find out all those leaked documents, thankfully, but we don't know everything. This next story, the Pirate Bay's heir apparent, is from Forbes.com, sent in by DC. The world of peer-to-peer piracy is in turmoil. In April, copyright-flouted icon The Pirate Bay was ordered by a Swedish court to shut down its file-sharing service. And last week, the second-largest file-sharing destination, Mininova, announced that it would comply with a court order to remove all of its copyright-infringing files. That leaves ISOHunt, a peer-to-peer file-sharing search engine with 30 million unique monthly visitors and 10 million daily searches, as the biggest remaining magnet for the web's pirate population. It's also attracting some legal troubles. The Vancouver-based site is being sued by both the Motion Picture Association of America and the Canadian Recording Industry Association. But ISOHunt founder Gary Fung argues that his site won't be the next to fall under legal guillotine. ISOHunt, he argues, uses a different model. Unlike Mininova or the Pirate Bay, the site functions as a search engine for the torrent files that map connections in peer-to-peer file-sharing networks, rather than a host of those files or a forum for downloaders. That, says Fung, means the site is no more culpable than Google for illegal use of its search tool. To prove it, Fung countersued CRIA in August, and after that claim was rejected on a technicality, did so again last week. Forbes spoke with Fung about his argument that ISOHunt is a legal site, his refusal to actively police the content it links, and to how Mickey Mouse screwed up American intellectual property law. Now, I'm not going to read out the whole interview. It's really good. You should definitely go and check it out and read it from the links in the forum. And see how he steps through in explaining how ISOHunt is exactly the same as Google. It is just a search engine. And there and the MPAA and CRIA is going after ISOHunt for doing exactly the same thing that Google is doing. Exactly the same thing. And he shows you how you can filter for just torrents on Google. And this has been known to myself for a long time, that you could just type in a little thing before your search on the top of Google, and it'll just search torrents. So he's explaining how his site is exactly the same, and it is, but this isn't a case of the MPAA and CRA going after the small guy. The small guy, not in terms of web searches, but the small guy in terms of monetary amounts. Google has deep pockets. ISOHunt has no pockets. So this, definitely read that interview. Next story, web giants attacked digital economy bill. And this is from zdnet.co.uk. Google, Yahoo, eBay, and Facebook have written to Lord Mandelson, asking him to remove measures in digital economy bill. And this is out of the UK. And this is associated with the song that I played last week at the end of the show, which say they could stifle which they say could stifle innovation and derail the government's plan for digital Britain. On Wednesday, executives from the European divisions of the internet companies sent the business minister in an open letter urging him to remove Clause 17 from the proposed law, which received its second reading in the House of Lords earlier the same day. We believe the bill's Clause 17, which gives any future Secretary of State unprecedented and sweeping powers to amend the Copyright, Design and Patent Act, opens the way for arbitrary measures, the companies wrote. This power could be used, for example, to introduce additional technical measures or increase monitoring of user data, even when no illegal practice has taken place. The clause, which already has attracted widespread criticism from digital rights activists, ISPs, and consumer groups, would give Mandelson or any other nominated person power to amend copyright law as they saw fit, nominally in order to keep up with changes in technology. The online companies say that this power will introduce business uncertainty and the potential for open-ended compliance costs to the UK's digital economy. This would discourage innovation, impose unnecessary costs, potentially unsettling the careful balance of responsibilities for enabling market change, which Lord Cartier outlined in the Digital Britain report, the letter said. This clause is so wide that it could put at risk legitimate consumer use of current technology as well as future developments. Clause 17 creates uncertainty for consumers and businesses and puts at risk the UK's leading position in a digital Europe. We urge you to remove Clause 17 from the bill, the companies wrote. Responding to the criticism of the clause, the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills said that the law must be drafted to include potential changes in technology so that the government could take action if new ways of infringing copyright were developed. However, businesses will not wake up one morning to a world in which government has taken extensive digital powers, a BIS spokesman said on Wednesday. There are substantial constraints on how the power will be used, with requirements for a consultation and votes in both House of Parliament before anything can happen. Also, the powers cannot be used to create or modify a criminal offense. It's always magical when corporate interests also lie on the same side of public interest. So at least there's some financial interest being in striking down unfair policies that go too far in copyrights, patents, and privacies. So it's kind of good that Google, Yahoo, eBay, and Facebook have some vested interest in this along with the public, because the government is liable to listen to them, but not completely, as you've seen in the responses here, that it's always the excuse, oh, this law will not be used for evil, is essentially what they're saying. We'll only use it for good. Well, why not write something in there so it guarantees that it won't be used for evil, so that you can, rather than just open-endedly being able to make up new laws as you see fit, just put it in there so that you don't have to make up laws as you see fit, so that they need to go through a review process so everybody is calm and collected about these things. It seems like a very natural progression that could take place. This next story, strange bedfellows oppose R18 plus games debate. This is out of Australia, for the Pirate Party Australians out there. It's from news.com.au. This was sent in by Damon Kin, and he says, Australia has an interesting view on video game censorship. At the moment, we cannot buy any game with more than an MA15 rating. My version of GTA 4, legally bought on day one of its release, is missing a whole heap of content found in the international version. Recently, Christian and pro-porn groups have banded together in opposing R18 rating in Oz. In a rare partnership, a Christian lobby group and pornography advocates have joined forces to criticize a plan to have public consultation in introducing R18 plus video games. Meeting in Adelaide today, the nation's attorneys general agreed to ask the public whether an R18 plus category for video games should be introduced. Games which exceed the top MA15 category cannot be sold in Australia. If an R18 plus class was introduced, it would allow adults to play video games involving graphic violence. The call for public consultation was immediately criticized by both the Australian Christian Lobby and the Eros Foundation, a pornography lobby group. Given what happens with R-rated films, we could have no confidence that the classification guidelines would be properly applied, ACL Managing Director Jim Wallace said in a statement. For example, due to a loophole in the guidelines, real sex is sometimes being shown in R-rated films. What will happen if we have R18 plus games, which will have even greater impact because of their interactive nature? A spokesman for Eros said the foundation backed the ACL's stance. We support the Australian Christian Lobby point of view, the spokesman said tonight, because we believe there's too much violence out there and there are more pressing issues for the attorneys to consider, such as the regulation of X-rated film industry. Home Affairs Minister Bob DeBoos said the consultation process would not deliver a final decision. This is not a consultation on a proposal to introduce an R18 plus level for games, Mr. DeBoos said in a statement. It is a public consultation process seeking community views to inform our position. Mr. DeBoos was keen to stress that the federal government has not reached an opinion yet. Consultation will allow us to form a view based on evidence about community views on the issue. Victorian Attorney General Rob Hull said he wanted censorship laws to strike an appropriate balance between freedom of expression and community concerns. It seems inconsistent that in Australia, adults are allowed to view adult-only films which have been classified R18 plus by the classification board, but not computer games with an equivalent high-level content, Mr. Hull said in a statement. Details of when consultation will begin were not immediately available. And this is a good example of how a rating system can get perversed under the guise of educating the public of content of video games and movie. They set up arbitrary levels of ratings, and you're allowed or not allowed to see certain things at a certain age, at a certain time, in certain countries. And it's very baffling when all these different laws are introduced and these different levels of what violence, what level of violence you can see, and what level of real life activity that you can see, or even in video games, not even real life activity, it's simulated life activity. It always seemed a bit absurd to me, these rating levels. Maybe you can just describe what's in it, and rather than apply a level to it, and parents can watch out for what their children are watching and seeing and buying, and if they're not watching out for what their children are seeing and buying, then maybe that's a problem with the parents and not the stuff that's being released into the public. This next story, 8 million reasons for real surveillance oversight. This is from dubfire.net. This one should scare you. Sprint Nextel provided law enforcement agencies with its customers' GPS location information over 8 million times between September 2008 and October 2009. This massive disclosure of sensitive customer information was made possible due to the rollout by Sprint of a new special web portal for law enforcement officers. The evidence documenting this surveillance program comes in the form of an audio recording of Sprint managers electronic surveillance, who described it during a panel discussion at a wiretapping and interception industry conference held in Washington, D.C. in October of 2009. It is unclear if federal law enforcement agencies' extensive collection of geolocation data should have been disclosed to Congress pursuant to a 1999 law that requires the publication of certain surveillance statistics, since the Department of Justice simply ignores the law and has not provided the legally mandated reports to Congress since 2004. Now, on this website that's linked, it used to have a recording of the executive at the person during the panel discussion saying that there was 8 million recordings of GPS information. But on the website now, it says, I received a phone call from an executive at Telestrategies, the firm who organized the ISS World Conference. He claimed that my recordings violated copyright law and asked that I remove the MP3 recordings of the two-panel session, as well as the YouTube, Vimeo, and ICBUS versions I had embedded onto this blog. While I believe that my recording and posting of this audio was lawful, as a good faith gesture, I have taken down the MP3s and the zip file from my web hosting account and removed the files from Vimeo, etc. And if you go down and look at the comments at the bottom of the page, you can still get the MP3s from people who have mirrored it. Remember, if it's on the web, it's mirrored on the web. And he goes in to say in his conclusion that the public available law enforcement surveillance statistics are at best misleading and at worst deceptive. It is simply impossible to have a reasonable debate among academics, public policymakers, and members of the public interest community when the very scale of these surveillance programs is secret. As an example, consider the following quote from November 4, 2009 markup hearing of the House Judiciary Committee, which is currently considering a bill to expand the government's Patriot Act surveillance power. During the hearing, Representative Lamar Smith, the ranking minority member, said the following. Unlike the tools which actually collect content, such as wiretaps, pen registers, and trap and trace device merely request outgoing and incoming phone numbers, because the government cannot collect any content using pen registers, a minimization requirement makes no sense. What is there to minimize? After reading the article, it should be clear to the reader that the pen registers, trap and trace devices are used for far more than just collecting phone numbers dialed. They're used to get email headers, including to, from, and subject lines, the URLs of web pages viewed by individuals, and in many situations, they're used along with Stored Communications Act requests to get geolocation information on phone mobile users. And he provides extensive information that you should go and check out on the website. It is incredibly frightening that this kind of stuff is not being released to the public, of what kind of information that is being collected on you and I every day in every activity that we are doing in real life, on online, using our phones, emailing each other. It is simply scary how much is being recorded backhandedly by the government and not being revealed, and even being suppressed by copyright violations, so that we can't even hear what is going on that should be public. I mean, this is not done in the guise of national security. This is done before the fact. They're not searching for stuff. They're recording everything of innocent people that have committed no crime, committing yours and mine activity before any crime has been committed. You are deemed guilty before innocent. You're being watched by the eyes of Big Brother. And this is not scaremongering. This is not tinfoil hat time. This is actually happening. This is real life. This isn't, yeah, they're listening through my walls. No, they are listening through your walls. Except your walls are digital. They're ones and zeros. They're being recorded and stored on a very large hard drive. And they won't tell you where it is. His next story, do music artists fare better in a world with illegal file sharing? This is from timesonline.co.uk. And there's some graphs on this website that you need to go and look at so you can appreciate what I'm talking about. This is the graph the record industry doesn't want you to see. It shows the fate of three main pillars of the music industry revenue: recorded music, live music, and PRS revenues. This is recordings collected on behalf of artists when their music is played in public over the last 5 years. We've broken each category into two subcategories so that for any chunk of revenue, recorded music sales, for instance, you can see the percentage that goes to the artist and the percentage that goes elsewhere. In the case of recorded music, the lion's share of revenue goes to the record label, and in the case of live, the promoter takes a cut, etc. Hopefully this analysis, and there's more on the nuts and bolts of our method below, shed some factual light on the claims and counterclaims that there are paranoiaically sweeping across the music industry establishment, not least that put forward by the singer Lily Allen in this paper recently, and the BPI, that artists are losing out as a result of the fall in sales of recorded music. The most immediate revelation, of course, is that at some point next year, revenues from gigs payable to artists will, for the first time, overtake revenues accrued by labels from sales of recorded music. Why live revenues have grown so stridently is beyond the scope of this article, but our data compiled from a PRS, a music report, and the BPI makes two things clear. One, that the growth in live revenue shows no signs of slowing, and two, that live is by far and away the most lucrative section of the industry revenue for artists themselves because they retain such a big percentage of the money from ticket sales. It is often claimed that the live revenues are only mostly benefiting so-called heritage acts. Unfortunately, the data doesn't shed any light on this because live revenues are not broken down by type of act, gig size, or ticket price. An even more striking thing, perhaps, emerges in the second graph, namely that revenues accrued by artists themselves have in fact risen over the past 5 years, despite the fall in record sales. All the blue bars in the chart above represent revenues that go directly to artists. As you can see, the blue total has risen noticeably. This is mostly because of live revenues, but also because of the growing amount collected by PRS on behalf of artists, which account for a much bigger chunk of the industry revenues than most people realize. It's interesting, too, that overall industry revenues have grown in the period, though admittedly not by much, which arguably adds the strength to the notion that when BPI releases its annual report claiming how much the music industry has suffered from the growth in illegal file sharing, what it perhaps should be saying is how much the record labels have suffered. For the people in the industry, not least artists, the future arguably holds on more promise. A couple of notes about our methods. The data, as pointed out, comes from the PRS and BPI. We're grateful to the PRS in particular for helping out with this a model to work without what percentage of the particular chunk of industry revenue was likely to be returned to artists. In the case of recording music, we used an average 90-10% split between labels and artists. In the case of live, we used a 90-10 split between artists and promoters. And he goes on to more about the analysis of his data. And now we know why the record industry is lobbying so hard against file sharing. It's because they're losing money. It's not because the artists are losing money. It's not for more money in the artist's pocket, as they claim, but for more money in their pockets they're lobbying for. And this should be a foregone conclusion. But it's always nice to see some people have some nice, easy-to-read graphs to illustrate the point. Now, you can always say, follow the money. Now, why would the record industry be crying, losing money, losing money, losing money? It's because they actually are losing money. But the artists are getting more money, and the industry itself is actually growing, as shown by those charts, if they're accurate. And the guy actually calls for any updates from any of these industries for more information so he can update these graphs if they are inaccurate. So whoever is crying the most, the music industry, is the one losing money. But the problem is, yes, they're losing money, but they're saying that it's because it's for the artists. It's for the artists. But the artists are not making less money. They're making more money. Check out those graphs. Very, very interesting. Next story is very disconcerting. This is for people in Turkey. Turkey tests new means of internet control. This is sent in by Crunch. This is from foreignpolicy.com. Many governments are unhappy about Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft. Those are too big to bully. It's much easier to bully local search engines and email providers. They are usually too timid to complain, and they have much more to lose. That's why, in fact, that more and more Chinese netizens seem to be drifting towards local versions of Web 2.0 services, a trend spotted by Michael Ante and others. And this is a bit disturbing. But let's face it, it's very hard to beat Google at search, email, and a gazillion other services that they offer. The Turkish leaders seem to believe otherwise. Tayfun Akarer, the chairman of Turkey's Information Technology and Communications Board, BTK, said that Turkish engineers are working on a Turkish search engine that is to launch in 2010. They expect it to be popular not just in Turkey but elsewhere in the Muslim world. Akarer says he is confident that these other countries will trust our search engine. Why would other countries want to use such an invention? Obviously, because it will have better editorial judgment than Google. That's in quotes, editorial judgment, i.e. omit whatever leaders of the Muslim world find offensive. According to Akarer, existing search engines are sometimes deaf to the country's sensitivities. Well, that hasn't been the case in Bing and Google search engine in the case of China, but I go on. This is not the first attempt to create such a search engine for Muslims. See my previous coverage here. Akarer also announced another project, the Anaposta. Now, this is the disconcerting one, and it sounds much more ominous than a pre-filtered search engine. The Anaposta would provide email accounts with a quota of 10 gigabytes to all of Turkey's 70 million citizens. Every child will have an email address written on his or her identity card since birth, said Akarer. So we'll have a mobile network that can be used thanks to an ID number match, and foreign networks such as Yahoo, Gmail, and Hotmail will not be used anymore. This doesn't get any more disturbing than this. Not only would the Turkish government completely eliminate anonymity on the internet, they would also be able to monitor all communication flows in real time, as email services would be provided by the government or structures related to the government. All internet communication data goes to foreign countries and then it returns. This activity has a security aspect, said Akarer. It can't be 100% certain, but I think most of the Turkish citizens would probably rather have their data go live somewhere on a Google server in California than to be looked at by Turkey's intelligence services on a server in Istanbul. But then again, I may be misjudging the mysterious Turkish soul. Now, this cradle-to-grave email address is a surveillance society's wet dream come true. But the chances of somebody solely using that government-mandated email address is next to zero. Soon, the citizens of Turkey will have to send innocuous emails through the government email address just to give the illusion that they're using it at all. All the while, they're also will be sending encrypted messages through another system. And now they're going to be in such a delusion. They're already saying, oh yeah, the Gmail and Hotmail and Yahoo won't be used anymore. They're in complete denial that they won't be used anymore. Only if it's mandated by law will they not be used anymore. Why would you want to send and receive your email through a government snoop project that's going to record every single piece of email that's ever been sent or received? Now, you could argue that Gmail is exactly the same thing, because they have such a huge store of information that if you never delete any of your emails, now I haven't looked into their privacy policy on deletion on email deletions, whether they get stored infinitely or not for backup purposes, or if even if you delete your stuff and you keep a lot of your email, which most people would keep a lot of their email and just kind of shuffle it off to the side into a red folder or something, that the government could just get a warrant to do a search on your emails. Now, I always believe in client-side emails, and you can encrypt it on your own own computer and don't leave it on anybody's server for whoever to do willy-nilly with it. But this is going a little bit too far. And they're under a delusion if they think that people are going to use it because it's a free service offered by the government of Turkey. There's plenty of other free services out there, but if it's mandated by law, they're going to be just be sending emails to keep up the illusion that they're using the government-mandated email system, and then alternatively going through something like Tor, encrypting their emails that they really want to send and communications that they really want to send anyway. But this is almost all moot because I hardly ever get emails from my friends anymore anyway. It's all through Facebook and social networking sites, which is also a Big Brother's wet dream because it's stored infinitely. Who's going to go back and delete all the posts that they've stored 2 years ago that they have to click individually delete, 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 delete forever? Anyway, next story. Court refuses to order shutdown of Open BitTorrent. And this is from torrentfreak.com. What a great website. If you haven't looked at torrentfreak.com, I get so much great stories from there. Make a bookmark of that site. Last month, the Swedish ISP Portlane was sued by several Hollywood movie studios for hosting Open BitTorrent, claiming that the tracker is a rebranded copy of one previously operated by the Pirate Bay. Now the Stockholm District Court has rejected calls to order the shutdown of the tracker. Earlier this year, a new BitTorrent tracker was launched. Due to its public nature, Open BitTorrent was seen by some as a possible replacement for the Pirate Bay tracker, which has recently closed down for good. Open BitTorrent is merely a tracker, carries no torrent files, and operates a full DMCA-style notice and takedown policy. Despite this, during mid-November, Hollywood movie studios moved to try and shut down the fledgling service. However, rather than deal with the tracker's operators, who we are told to offer offer to cooperate, they instead sued the site's hosting provider, Portlane. Open BitTorrent is used for file sharing, and we suspect that this is the Pirate Bay tracker with a new name. It is added by default on all the torrent tracker files on Pirate Bay, Hollywood lawyer Monique Wadsted said in a comment. Even though it was agreed that the tracker could be used to facilitate the distribution of copyrighted works, the Stockholm District Court has now rejected Hollywood's request to shut down Open BitTorrent. The court ruled that in order for Portlane to be considered as contributing to copyright infringement, it must be guilty of more than just providing internet access to the site. We are happy with the court's decision. It is indeed the only correct decision. We as an ISP should neither act nor get the task to police the internet, a Portlane spokesperson told Torrent Freak in a statement. Hollywood lawyer Monique Wadsted is disappointed that the court didn't consider their suspicions that OBT is linked to Pirate Bay. The court has not touched on the link between the tracker and the Pirate Bay, and that all the torrent files in the Pirate Bay include OBT's tracker as the default tracker, she said in a statement, adding, the day we checked, there were 550,000 works that file sharers could download through the tracker. The district court's decision is interim, and the issue will be settled fully sometime next summer. And now the movie studios are getting so brave as they're going after the technology itself by targeting trackers that don't even host a searchable database. They're just going after technology. Me, myself, I use open torrent trackers that for my projects that I distribute. But I use like four or five of them that I put in my torrent files so that in case one of these gets shut down or they're offline, that it can just go to the next one. But the movie studios are going after these open torrent sites that don't index, that don't store any torrents data. And it's nothing more than a tool that can be used for whatever the public wants, including myself, for hosting my own works that I make. It's the same as shutting down an email server or a phone system because somebody was conversing about something illegal on it, or outlawing cars because they've caused so many accidents over the years. It's going after the tool and not the person who is wielding the tool. It is a misdirection of what they need to focus their attention on. They're going willy-nilly against anything that remotely looks like the Pirate Bay or that sounds like the Pirate Bay or is even remotely associated with the Pirate Bay in any way. It's as if the Pirate Bay has become the magical new word. Instead of terrorist, it's become the Pirate Bay. Shut it down. It's the badness has come. So, the next story, major label messes with the wrong guy. This is sent in by DC, this is from Wired.com. Tim Quirk, a senior vice president at the digital music service Rhapsody, used to front a band that was signed to the one of the major labels, Warner Brothers. His experience at Rhapsody taught him firsthand that it's possible to build a big database that accounts for what each copyright holder is owed. However, he and others contend major labels have no incentive to put such a transparent database in place. Quite the opposite. They only stand to benefit by obfuscating the accounting process for middle and long-tail bands and tracking their digital streams and downloads casually. Quirk estimated that his band's three out of print major label releases should have been earned between two and five times as much as digital revenue as its four independently released albums earned, given that they are far more popular. But when he compared the IODA's payout to Warner Brothers' payout over the same five-year period, he was shocked to discover the reverse to be true. His band earned about $12,000 from the independent albums distributed digitally through IODA, but only $62.40 from Warner Brothers. So $395,000 of the band's advance remains unrecouped, meaning that it owes the amount against future royalties earned. Quirk doesn't think his band will ever recoup that sizable advance, but it's the principle of the thing. By refusing to update their accounting technology for dealing with revenue from digital streams and downloads, data that musical services such as Rhapsody and iTunes already delivered to the label anyway, he claims major labels are letting all sorts of digital revenue slip through the cracks and into their coffers, not to mention absorbing large upfront royalty advances from music startups. We all know that major labels are supposed to be venerable masters of hiding money from artists, but they're also supposed to be good at it, right? Quirk asks in his post. The whole saga makes for a fascinating, if somewhat lengthy, read. Now, it's extremely interesting, and on his site, after this was posted, there was a whole bunch of updates and clarifications from him and his company and Warner Brothers and a whole bunch of, this isn't how it's supposed to be. So go take a look at that. Very interesting story, very interesting amounts that are claimed, and this is the same kind of Hollywood math, it's called. And you can look it up on Wikipedia. It's called Hollywood math, and they hide amounts that are actually earned by pushing it under and not recording it, and it's very sketchy kind of math that they're doing. And luckily he has the inside track and is knowing what's going on because he's on both sides of the table. He's an artist, and he also runs, you know, Rhapsody. So, senior vice president of Rhapsody. So he has a bit of an inside knowledge of what's going on. And he also has releases independently and through a major label. He's in a perfect position, and they never take into account that there's always going to be an exception to the rule like this. And people are going to speak up about what's going on, these shady deals going on behind closed doors, or just the willful ignorance of not paying their artists. So I'm glad these kind of stories are emerging today, so there's a lot of good positive stories coming out rather than the negative about artists in this new realm of digital distribution of music. And for that fact, movies. And this next story is the start of a worldwide biometric database. The U.S. Canada to share refugees' biometric info. This is from Canada.com. Seeking to enhance its effort to crack down on fraudulent refugee claims, the Harper government on Tuesday announced it has struck a deal to share fingerprint information on asylum seekers with the United States. Public Safety Minister Peter Van Loan made the announcement following a bilateral summit here with U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. Under the protocol, the U.S. will join a biometric data sharing initiative Canada has already launched last summer with the United Kingdom and Australia. Biometrics continue to be a powerful tool to prevent terrorists and criminals from crossing our border, shared border, and prevent identity theft and asylum fraud. Napolitano said in a news conference with Van Loan. Canada's Privacy Commissioner, Jennifer Stoddart, had expressed a series of concerns about the biometric data sharing when the plan was first announced in August. Stoddart's office questioned Ottawa about the need to collect fingerprints and sought assurances that the personal information gathered would not be used for secondary purpose. While we're still reviewing their response on the surface, it appears that they have addressed most of our concerns, said Anna Marie Hayden, a spokesman for the Privacy Commissioner. They advised us that under the protocol, biometric information will only be used for immigration and national issues. They've also told us the biometric matching information will only be one of the many elements considered when assessing a file. The Privacy Commissioner's office is still awaiting a response, however, on how Citizenship and Immigration Canada plans to address our concerns about how refugees, a very vulnerable population, will be notified about the collection and use of their biometric information, Hayden said. Now, I know I was very upset when I went to Japan for my honeymoon last year and had to submit my very first piece of biometrics that I've ever given up to any industry, any government, or any private corporation, and I had to give it up to the Japanese government. When I was entering into their country, they photograph and fingerprint every single traveler that enters Japan. Now, the combination of biometrics, data sharing, and the ever-present so-called security CCTV cameras are beginning to form a world without privacy. Now, my fingerprints in the Japanese database only takes an agreement between Japan and Canada and Japan and U.S. or Japan and a world consortium to share my biometric information that could result in false accusations of myself if ever a crime scene is dusted and they find fingerprints at the crime scene, even though I visited it an hour before the crime happened. This is a very slippery slope, dangerous slippery slope, of guilt before innocence. Now, why should they be collecting my fingerprints when I have not done anything and I am presumed innocent and should be presumed innocent of doing anything? I should only be investigated if I am under suspicion. Now, is everybody under suspicion now? Is this a world that you want to live in where everybody is under suspicion 24/7? It's as if the boom of the reality television shows coincided perfectly with our real-world loss of piracy to almost ease us into this upcoming land of Big Brother. It's almost natural to see people televised, cleverly edited together on television to present an evil or good view of them. And this is really distressing mirror look at our world view now, where we're almost used to this kind of surveillance society, and it frightens me that we're being lulled into this like a boiling frog. Now, this next one was sent in by DC. This is Yahoo and Verizon. Our spy capabilities would shock and confuse consumers. This is from PrivacyDigest.com. Want to know how much phone companies and internet service providers charge to funnel your private communications or records to U.S. law enforcement and spy agencies? That's the question Mudraker and Indiana University graduate student Christopher Sogoyan asked all agencies within the Department of Justice under a Freedom of Information Act request filed a few months ago. But before the agencies could provide the data, Verizon and Yahoo intervened and filed an objection on grounds that, among other things, they would be ridiculed and publicly shamed were their surveillance prices sheets made public. Yahoo writes in its 12-page objection letter that if pricing information were disclosed to Sogoyan, he would use it to shame Yahoo and other companies and to shock their customers. Therefore, release of Yahoo's information is reasonably likely to lead to impairments of its reputation for protection of user privacy and security, which is a competitive disadvantage for technology companies, the company writes. Verizon took a different stance. It objected to the release of its law enforcement legal compliance guide because it might confuse customers and lead them to think that records and surveillance capabilities available only to law enforcement would be available to them as well, resulting in a flood of customer calls to the company asking for trap and trace orders. Customers may see a list of records, information, or assistance that is available to only law enforcement, Verizon writes in its letter. But call into Verizon and seek those same services, such calls would stretch limited resources, especially those reserved only for law enforcement agents emergencies. Other customers, upon seeing the types of surveillance law enforcement can do, might become unnecessarily afraid that their lines have been tapped, or call Verizon to ask if their lines have been tapped, a question we can't answer. Verizon does disclose a little tidbit in its letter, saying that the company receives tens of thousands of requests annually for customer records and information from law enforcement agencies. Sequoyan filed his records request to discover how much law enforcement agencies, and thus U.S. taxpayers, are paying for spy documents and surveillance services with the aim of trying to deduce how often such requests are being made. Sequoyan explains in his theory on the blog, Slight Paranoia. In the summer of 2009, I tried to follow the money trail in order to determine how often internet firms were disclosing their customers' private information to the government. I theorized that if I could obtain the price lists of each ISP, detailing the price for each kind of services and invoices paid by the various parts of federal government, then I might be able to reverse engineer some approximate statistics. In order to obtain these documents, I filed for the Freedom of Information Act requests with every part of the Department of Justice I could think of. The first Department of Justice agency to respond to his request was the U.S. Marshals Services, which indicated that it had price lists available for Cox Communications, Comcast, Yahoo, and Verizon. But since the companies voluntarily provided the price list to the government, the Freedom of Information Act allows companies an opportunity to object to the disclosure of their data under various exemptions. Comcast and Cox were fine with the disclosure. Sequoyan reported. He found that Cox Communication charges $2,500 to fulfill a pen register trap and trace order for 60 days, and $2,000 for each additional 60-day interval. It charges $3,500 for the first 30 days of a wiretap, and $2,500 for each additional 30 days. 30 days worth of a customer's call detail records cost $40. Comcast's pricing list, which was already leaked to the internet in 2007, indicated that it charges at least $1,000 for the first month of a wiretap and $750 per month thereafter. But Verizon and Yahoo took offense at the request. Now, this is the most pathetic excuses I've heard to not release information. And this is a perfect reason why the information should be released. I mean, if it's going to scare the customers and shock and confuse them, maybe it should be released because it is scary information. And the public has a right to know that. If they're paying for this wiretap, maybe not the information should be available to them, but at least how much they're paying for it out of their own taxes should be available to them. But obviously, that's not allowed. A pub fined for illegal downloads over Wi-Fi. This is sent in by DC. This is from pcpro.co.uk, and this is a story out of the UK. A pub has been reportedly fined £8,000 after a customer downloaded copyrighted material on its Wi-Fi connection. The managing director of Wi-Fi hotspot provider The Cloud told ZDNet.uk that the fine has been levied in a civil case this summer, following a successful prosecution by the rights holder. The Cloud declined to name the pub involved, but the provider has contracts with the pub chains including Fuller's, Green King, and Punch Taverns. It is believed to be the first time that a Wi-Fi hotspot provider has been held legally responsible for the activities of its customers and create a highly undesirable precedent for venues such as pubs, cafes, and restaurants that offer free or paid-for Wi-Fi connections to their customers. Legal experts are baffled by the ruling. Internet law professor Lillian Edwards of Sheffield Law School told ZDNet that companies that operate public Wi-Fi hotspots should not be responsible in theory for users' illegal downloads under existing substantive copyright law. Even the tougher anti-piracy measures included in the forthcoming digital economy bill would not hold hotspot providers responsible for the action of their customers. The news comes as lawyers prepare to send out more than 15,000 new demands for compensation to people accused of downloading copyrighted material, according to the BBC, which we reported on last week. Previous campaigns have seen films demand up to £600 for the downloading of a single game. Firms demand up to £600 for the downloading of a single game. And if the two or three strike rule goes into effect, you'll see more of this happening because people won't be able to access their internet at home. They'll be banned, legally banned from being able to access their internet at home. So where are they going to go? They're going to go to the local coffee shop, to the local pub to get internet access. But that's going to be gone too, because these pubs are going to shut down their Wi-Fi access if they're going to be levied these fines. Where are people going to get their internet from? They're going to get it from nowhere. The internet is going to be available only for the protected few that are not being accused of copyright violation, not convicted of it, not taken to court, but accused two or three times. And this sharing is likely to go underground, and people are going to be piggybacking on other people's connections more and more, and possibly being almost forced into, you know, shady practices of maybe going on people's Wi-Fi that don't really want them on their Wi-Fi, next door neighbors, in fact. And people are going to be, because there's going to be a witch hunt by the corporations, the music and movie corporations, to shut down anybody's connection that's going to be accused two or three times. They're going to be starting to shut down your neighbor's Wi-Fi, even though the neighbor did nothing of the sort. And they're going to be without internet for doing nothing at all other than being accused of copyright violations. This next one was also sent in by DC. The anti-piracy group refuses bait, and DRM breaker goes to the police. This is from torrentfreak.com. In order to force a change in the law, last month, a man reported himself for breaching copyright on more than 100 times, hoping that anti-piracy group would take him to court. The group's lawyer said they were to respond by today. They haven't. So the Danish copy fighter is now reporting himself to the police. At the end of October, a Danish citizen took drastic action to draw attention to some restrictive and seemingly contradictory copyright legislation. Henrik Andersen told Torrent Freak that in order to force his government's hand on laws which allowed him to copy DVDs for his own personal use, but forbid him to remove the DRM in order to do so, he decided to turn himself in. Henrik informed the Danish anti-piracy outfit Antipiratgruppen that he had broken DRM on more than 100 legally purchased DVDs, movies, and TV shows for his use in his home media center, an act forbidden but also seemingly allowed under Danish laws, both detailed below. Under Clause 12, 1, anyone is entitled to make or have made for private purposes single copies of works which have been made public if this is not done for commercial purposes. Such copies must not be used for any other purpose, which he did. Also, it is not permitted without the consent of the right holder to make circumvent of effective technological measures, which he did. So both of these are contradicting themselves. It goes on, I have stated this because I don't want to be a criminal, Henrik told us, in his own similarly and deliberately contradictory way, noting that he'd requested a response by the group today, December 1st, 2009, indicating whether or not they intend to prosecute him. However, in the period up to today, Henrik had heard nothing from Antipiratgruppen, although their lawyer, Thomas Schluter, did speak to Danish press, saying that it was a political matter, but had nevertheless responded to the issue to the Association of Danish Video Distributors for consideration. In response, their chairman, Paul Doyloff, said that they would have a meeting to decide whether to report the matter to the police. Antipiratgruppen said it would reply to Henrik by the date he requested, and seems they have broken their promise. Today was the last chance for the anti-piracy group to come up with the answer, Henrik told Torrent Freak a few minutes ago. And although, as you know, they told the press that they would give me an answer before the 1st of December, they had not done that. Henrik told us that even though he has broken the law, anti-pirate Gruppen doesn't seem interested in responding. They are obviously aware that there will be an outrage if they reported me to the police, he points out. The other possibility, he says, that the anti-pirate Gruppen themselves doesn't see his actions as illegal, but this creates another problem. The Ministry of Culture has already written to Henrik informing him that breaking DRM in this way is against the law. Clearly frustrated, Henrik told us, but who should I follow? Those that determine the law in this country, or those who are lawyers for the companies that I'm committing the crime against? But Henrik has a solution to their inaction. I've decided to see if I can report myself directly to the police, for the case must be resolved, he told us. Henrik feels that the situation he is trying to draw attention to can only be solved by him going to trial. Hopefully, then, the Minister for Culture in the Danish Parliament will see that the law has to be changed. Well, it takes a very brave person to put themselves in the line like this to get clarification when the lawmakers start to speak out both sides of their mouth, and I applaud him, and I wish him good luck, because, it really takes a lot to do that, to turn yourself into the police, put your arms out, and say, cuff me, take me to jail, I am disobeying the laws. Well, I'm disobeying one law while following another. It's a very, very strange situation that really needs to be looked at, because this goes against private, personal use of things that you have bought yourself, and the prevention of doing that. And this is really a big thing that the Pirate Party is working towards, is personal use of things that you have bought and be able to do whatever you like with it. Right now, there is no legal way to play a DVD on a Linux system. Still, there is no way, and we're already to Blu-rays, and there's still no way to legally play a Blu-ray on a Linux system either. And this is the kind of thing that we're looking into. And speaking of Pirate Party, the Pirate Party news. ACTA, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement. This is from the pirateparty.ca website, Canadian Pirate Party website, and I believe a lot of the other Pirate Party websites have also posted this as well, because there is a concerted effort, a conglomerate put together by all the pirate parties through the Pirate Party International to get something going together against ACTA. So visit your local Pirate Party website in your country to read more about this. And if there is nothing on your Pirate Party website, or if you don't have one in your own country, head over to the pirateparty.ca one, and this is what it reads. ACTA, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, a secret international treaty that a dozen countries are already on board for, Canada and the U.S. included. Negotiations have consistently been kept secret from both the public and directly elected politicians such as National Parliament. The practice is overly corrosive to democracy and is corrupting global society. The content of the treaty is with corporate lobbyists primarily connected to intellectual property rights into the industries, going under the name of cleared advisors, but the process respects neither the input of the public nor other effective stakeholders such as ISPs. Effectively, a small part of parties affected by the treaty are allowed to give feedback and input on the text, something otherwise denied even members of Parliament. The involved government figures are trying to create legislation and bypass any public review, knowing that they have the academic consensus against them, and that once the treaty is signed, it will be extremely hard to reverse. Other countries will then be pressured into signing the treaty, but they will not have any part in writing or amending it. The treaty will strongly limit civil liberties, especially regarding access to knowledge and culture. These agreements are remarkably obstructive to developing countries that do not yet have a developed IP industry. We risk repeating history of powerful nations' colonization of underdeveloped countries. This is intellectual slavery. The supposed content of the treaty aside, the process itself in which is created and implemented in the global political framework is to be condemned, and the treaty should be stopped and abolished, regardless of the content. No democracy, no democratic country should be allowed to implement legislation in such a way as it is about to happen with ACTA. The way ACTA is implemented resembles a global dictatorship of certain industry branches in complete disregard for maintainable development of society, civil liberties, and proper democratic due process. The sole purpose of this treaty is to implement extreme legislation on a global scale without any public participation. This matter does not just affect the pirate parties, but all democracy-respecting organizations. A worldwide united front of freedom-loving citizens is needed to impede this global assault against democracy and civil liberties for each and every human being. We urge you to take this matter to the streets, your friends and families, to stop ACTA very soon, or it may be too late. Sincerely, Jake Danes, leader of the Pirate Party of Canada, Pirate Party International Task Force Liaison for the PPCA. So check with your local Pirate Party to see what you can do against the ACTA. So inform yourself about ACTA as much as you can, because it is a secret document, so there's only so much you can learn about it. But the big point is that it is a secret document being negotiated between our country's leaders and the corporations to restrict our freedoms. This is from Australian Pirate Party. They're seeking 500 founding members. They're getting ready to organize and become a political party in Australia. Congratulations. This is from Torrent Freak, and you can also get it on the Australian website, Australian Pirate Party website. This year, pirate parties have emerged all over the world, putting copyright, censorship, and privacy issues on the political agenda. Down under, the Australian Pirate Party is eager to join in. They are currently seeking 500 founding members in order to become registered as an official political party. 2009 has been a disastrous year for several well-established torrent sites, with the Pirate Bay and Mini Nova losing its court against the entertainment industries. Not completely unrelated, this year has been very successful for one for the political Pirate Party movement. The Pirate Party currently holds 2 seats in the European Parliament thanks to the massive support from Swedish voters. In the aftermath of its accomplishments, several new parties were formed worldwide. In the UK, the Pirate Party officially registered at the Electoral Commission in August, and Canada has pursuing the same goals for a while, now followed by Australia. The Pirate Party Australia just announced that it is accepting founding members in their attempt to get the party officially registered with the Australian Electoral Commission. In order to get registered, the party needs 500 members who sign and send in their application form, plus a $20 founders fee. With this small but significant step, we will be one step closer to providing Australian electors with the option of voting pirate at the next federal election to fight for a fairer and more balanced copyright, greater innovation and access to culture, information and knowledge, greater government transparency, and the protection of our civil liberties, the party announced. David Crafty, the president of Pirate Party Australia, stresses the importance of a political party that defends citizens' rights against the ever-growing power of pro-copyright lobbyists. With the current government attempting to implement an internet censorship regime, continuing secretive ACTA negotiations, and an increasingly belligerent war on sharing, here and across the globe, it is now more important than ever that we work to protect our civil liberties and our democracy, Crafty said. The Aussie Pirate Party hopes to have the 500 required membership applications in before the end of the year. They encourage prospective members to send in their application forms as soon as possible so the party can be officially registered and get to work. So all the Australians listening out there, go to the Australian Pirate Party website and go check it out and sign up and help support the Pirate Party Australia to get registered as a federal party. And this is in from Christian Engstrom, the pirate member of European Parliament. And it's called Let's Write an Internet Bill of Rights. So he's getting all the ideas together for an Internet Bill of Rights to present to the European Parliament. And you can get to it from christianengstrom.wordpress.com and look up Let's Write an Internet Bill of Rights. The Pirate Party and the Green Group in the European Parliament are planning to put forward an Internet Bill of Rights. What do you think it should contain? We haven't written one yet, and we want to try a new way of doing so. We want to draft it together with the swarm on the Internet. Everybody is hereby invited to participate and contribute. We'll start with a free-form discussion, especially on 2 topics. What should be in it, and what existing documents are there that we can cut and paste from? The second question comes not out of just laziness, a desire to work out of laziness, a desire to work efficiently, but for more a fundamental reason. We don't want to reinvent new fundamental rights unless we absolutely have to. We want to recognize that the fact that the internet is an essential part of our society's information infrastructure and clarify that our fundamental human rights apply there as well, just like in the rest of society. So you can go to his website and find out a lot of more information about that. So if you're in the European Union, check that out and give him your opinions and help him draft a really good Internet Bill of Rights for European Union to protect your rights over there. For the end of the show, I'll be reading something called Knock Knock Acta, It's the Internet, that may be of some interest to Mexican Pirate Party members, because this is written out of Mexico, or dealing specifically with Mexico and the Acta meetings that are going to be happening there in January 2010. So if you have any news stories you'd like to hear on the show, questions or comments, just head over to piratepartyradio.com and submit them through the form on the website. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio. Dear ACTA Secret Committee, your actions regarding anti-counterfeiting trade agreement have garnered the attention of us, the Internauts. Since your seventh meeting is set to take place in Mexico, January 2010, the general Mexican media and news agencies have come under our scrutiny. During our observations, we have come across tendentious headlines allegating that there is a correlation between file sharing, the traffic of narcotics, and counterfeit goods. The fatal loss generated by organized crime at the detriment of Mexican society are presented as an allegory for the hypothetically devastating effects of file sharing on the impalpable copyright industry. It has come to our understanding that the Fifth Global Congress on Combating Counterfeiting and Piracy, focusing on the impact of illegal trade of tangible goods, will be held in the sunny beaches of Cancun, Mexico, on the 1st to the 3rd of December. An issue which is within the calamity of ACTA. We have fair reason to believe that some of the following organizations present at the reunion defending private interests are concerned by the way we are internauts share what we value on the internet. IMPI, Mexican Institute for Intellectual Property, the World Customs Organization, World Intellectual Property Organization, the International Chamber of Commerce, International Trademark Association, and International Security Management Association, together with Interpol. The timing, location, and sponsor of this Congress are to us internauts a source of concern. This Congress could set forth a precedent framing the circulation of intellectual property within the confinements of criminal activity, with no offense intended to the local populace. A location not reputed for corruption and its lack of transparency would in our eyes be more appropriate to host a meeting whose conclusion will affect billions of citizens worldwide. The sponsor of the event, media conglomerate Televisa, a private corporation, benefactor, and proponent of Mexico's leery digital spectrum deregulation, cannot within reason be considered an uninterested or trustworthy party. We, the internauts and international clusters, demand that both the dates this Congress will be held and the contents of the treaty be publicly available prior to its enactment. As has been demonstrated by the negative repercussions the transnational NAFTA treaty has had on the economic and social development of countries like Mexico, we, the internauts, refute the idea of having a treaty that could potentially prevent the flow of information and knowledge. Specifically considering that the director of your host, IMPI, was one of the lead negotiators of the NAFTA treaty. To add a humoristic undertone in these dark and eerie times where the fundamental concept of net neutrality is being ignored, the internets would like to remind the ACTA committee that the internet by design has been proven to be tremendously inconvenient for shipping drugs through the TCP ports. Counterfeit designer handbags simply
simply do not fit through the intertubes. And the packets carried over the internet can, by today's design, not contain DVD or CD plastic cases. In short, organized crime cannot send any type of solid goods through the internets. Information, knowledge, and data love are still the only goods that can flow freely through the cables. This is the sole and only purpose of the internets. We hope that you will find this information to be useful and that you will keep this insight in consideration during your upcoming meeting. Those of us who can tell the difference between file sharing and counterfeit deem it of vital importance that you focus on the current situation in Mexico. It is to us clear that there is no coincidence that this Congress is to be held here and now, and that it is likely nothing more than the preparation for the coming ACTA meeting. The future of what we call the internet is at stake. Make it clear that if this goes through, global and international actions are to be expected. File sharing is not counterfeiting.